Sure. So, the only problem is it'll probably go longer than 17 minutes.
Yeah, no, no.
You're listening to Appointed, a podcast from the office of Senator Kim Page. So, Kim, I'm working on a research project right now that has me thinking a lot about history and how Canadians aren't very good at learning about our history. So I'm wondering if you can tell me maybe one story in Canadian history that you think every Canadian resident should know.
Well, one story that increasingly people know something about but for years didn't was residential schools and the impact or the extent of racism, historical racism and colonialism within our country, whether it's slavery, the history of slavery that many people didn't know we had, whether it's the history of trying to assimilate by eradicating Indigenous people. Those are histories that I think many people are increasingly aware of, but you know, many of us, certainly my generation, didn't learn about that in school, and my hope is that kids now will be learning about those stories.
So when I talk about decarceration, I'm talking about more than just getting people out of prison. I'm also talking about healing trauma, preventing social harm, restoring substantive human rights, and bringing an end to the carceral state. So I think that decarceration can also mean state-funded farmer care, dental care, child care, and minimum guaranteed income. But we can also save some of that for future episodes. So what does decarceration mean to you, Kim?
Well, it means all of those things, and it means fundamentally that people are starting at an equal place. And so the presumption, you know, often we'll hear people say, well, you know, people wouldn't be in prison if they hadn't committed offenses. And I often think of the Anatole France quote, which is in basically something like, you know, the law applies equally to the rich and the poor. Neither is permitted to sleep under bridges or steal bread. The reality is that people who have more resources, who have privilege and access to other ways to feed themselves, to have a place to sleep, aren't likely to be in that position. And so to be substantively equal means that we actually have people starting out in a place where they're less likely to be in a situation that would cause them to come to the attention of the state in a way that is negative or would allow the state to feel it's authorized to actually intervene and criminalize and imprison people. And so it's all of the things you talked about. It's certainly universal basic income, guaranteed livable income, as I like to refer to it. It's certainly free education, not just for elementary school and high school, but also post-secondary, because we know that countries, and it's also pharmacare, dental care, mental health care, child care, because we know that all of the countries that have the highest standard of living and have more opportunities of those sorts have the lowest crime rates and also have their happier countries. I mean, people are more fulfilled living in those communities and countries. And it's interesting just seeing what's coming out of Finland now as they've just finished some research on this and showing exactly that.
Our next guest is Yusuf Fakiri. His brother, Soliman, had schizophrenia and was beaten to death in an Ontario jail. Soliman's family insists that Soliman shouldn't have been incarcerated in the first place. We're going to talk more to Yusuf after this, but for our listeners, how does the horrible story of Soliman's death inform our understanding of decarceration?
Well, certainly Soliman, Ashley Smith, countless other young people, men and women who are in the system and who have histories of past trauma, who have then developed mental health issues, whose mental health issues are exacerbated by the conditions under which they're held by the state. all underscore the fact that we should be investing those resources in community, in ways to support people being in community, not putting them in prisons and certainly not putting them in segregation cells, and treating them in ways that allow the state to feel authorized to treat them in a punitive way. And when we see people treated in these ways, it's not that you start out with a whole bunch of people generally going into prisons, staff members intending to brutalize people. But when you have people with mental health issues, but you have staff who are trained to believe people are fully capable of making decisions about their behavior and don't think in terms of the need for trauma-informed approaches or therapeutic interventions. And even if they are trained in those areas, fundamentally, they're still in situations where they're guarding people. And so they, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had staff members, particularly therapists, particularly psychiatrists, even in institutions that are duly designated psychiatric hospitals and prisons, talk about the fact that in a prison setting, security always trumps therapy. And when you have that, and then you add on top of that people who are getting frustrated, who are underpaid, who are, and individuals who aren't getting the support they need, then you end up seeing situations that very quickly escalate. And behavior, you know, we saw it with Ashley Smith, her family, when they saw some of the videos of her behavior by the end of her life. They had never seen that kind of behavior. She didn't, you know, to desire human contact. None of us, I think, or most of us, can't imagine wanting human contact so much that we would do something that would put our lives at risk rather than not have human contact. And that's what she was doing by the end of her life. I don't know. I didn't know Soliman. I don't know what else was happening for him he may have been doing that his family wouldn't have recognized. From what I understand, neither does his family, because they were denied access to him, which is a whole other issue. So when we talk about this, there are provisions right now in the law that allow courts, allow corrections to take people, to not put people in prison in the first place, or to take them out of prison and put them into appropriate mental health facilities. And too few of those are used. And I think Soliman's case is emblematic of why we need to be demanding that people not be incarcerated in the first place, particularly if they have mental health issues. And if they are, as soon as that becomes apparent, that they should be decarcerated immediately.
Yusuf Fakiri is Soliman Fakiri's oldest brother and a co-founder of the Justice for Soli campaign. The Justice for Soli campaign was founded after the tragic death of Soliman Fakiri, a 30-year-old Canadian man who was killed by guards on December 15, 2016, while temporarily in custody at a provincial correctional facility in Lindsay, Ontario. Soliman's story was recently featured on the Fifth Estate.
This is incident KL16010348, the death investigation of Soliman Fakiri. This is a video of Unit 8 segregation at the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay.
My family's been waiting for answers for the last year and a half. Why did my brother get killed under government care? Why did he have 50 bruises on his body? Why was both his hand and his legs tied?
A few months ago, Yusuf Fakiri reached out to me about his 30-year-old brother who had died inside this Ontario jail under suspicious circumstances.
I need the Fifth Estate to help us. I want to know what happened to my brother.
Staff at the facility were aware of Soliman's mental illness, schizophrenia. The Justice for Soli campaign is demanding for transparency and accountability by calling for criminal charges to be laid against the guards who are responsible for Soliman's death. Next, we speak with Soliman's brother, Yusuf. So, Yusuf, tell me about your brother. What was he like?
Soliman, there's so many things I could take all day to describe him, but he was a man known for his brilliance. He was for his kindness, his generosity, And there, you know, he did certain things that has remained in our memory forever. That's left us, you know, quite, that's left that profound void. Like, for example, with respect to his intellect, you know, he spoke three languages: Arabic, English, and Farsi. Prior to his illness, he was actually studying at the University of Waterloo's engineering program. And even in high school, while he was a straight A student, he played on both the rugby and the football team. So he's a man with many talents. That was a constant theme throughout his entire life. And even after his illness, although he did not finish his university studies, he ended up picking up the third language that I just mentioned, Arabic. That was his intellect. In terms of the character, he had one of the best characters you could ask for anybody. He was extremely, extremely generous to everyone around him. For example, like, there was one time when, like, I think this was a few months before his death. A year before his death. It was winter, and I was about to go to work, and I couldn't find my toque. And he gave me his toque, and he gave me a kiss on the forehead. I mean, small things like that. He had two nephews and nieces. A couple months before his death, actually, he bought them toys. He was loved by all of them. And he had a special relationship with every single family member. And that's probably been the most difficult part for my family. My mother and I, my Suleiman and my mother were best friends. He actually taught her Arabic. He taught me personally how to pray. He taught my youngest brother how to drive. To the nephews and nieces, he was their favorites because he showed this insatiable love that no one else in the family could. And this is considering that someone that was struggling with such a difficult illness. So I could talk all day, but those are some things of Suleiman.
You two must have had a pretty special relationship because he was right under you, right? He was 2 years younger than you, and you're the eldest, so.
Yes, we were very close. Growing up, there was this, you know, as all siblings have, this rivalry, and, you know, usually it's the oldest, it's the youngest sibling that looks up to the oldest, but for us, it was the other way around. I would always look up to him because he was very special. He was extremely special. Like he was able to walk into a room and make everyone around him smile. But him and I, like, there's times where, like, you know, one time we got lost on a, you know, on a family vacation. It was just him and I, and we were both scared. We got lost in another country, and he ended up telling me, you know, years later that, like, oh, see, I wasn't afraid, Yusuf, you were, right? Like, just this banter. And we would play video games together, and he'd always beat me and my other siblings in video games. So
what happened to your brother?
So he was temporarily taken into custody on December 4th. 2016, after an incident with the neighbors. My family was not there when this incident took place, taken it into custody temporarily at the Central East Correctional Center. So when he was there for 11 days, and it was as if he was thrown into a dark hole to never be seen again. He left us as a healthy man, but he was given to us in a body bag. In those 11 days, we tried so hard to see him. My parents and my parents tried to see him three times. Myself and my younger brother tried to see him once. And to this day, we have not been given a reason as to why we weren't able to see him. We never were able to see him in those intervening 11 days. And the time that I went there, I told staff at the facility that Suleiman had a mental illness. So they were aware of this. In addition to the fact that at this time, Suleiman was 30, he was diagnosed with his illness of schizophrenia when he was 19. So it was already 11 years documented. But I told staff there, and they were aware. And a couple of days before his death, an arrangement was made for him to be transferred to the Ontario Shores Center for Mental Health. And my family was very happy about that, you know, for Suleiman to get help, you know, to be in a place that can help him. And in the end, that's probably one of the most tragic parts of his story, is that he was supposed to get help, and his help was on the way when he was supposed to be transferred. He was waiting for a bed, and instead, on that climactic day of, you know, that fateful day of December 15, 2016, he mercilessly lost his life at the hands of the very individuals that were supposed to take care of him and protect him. And according to the coroner's report, there was 50 bruises on Suleiman's death. 50. None were related to life-saving attempts. None were self-inflicted by him. 50 bruises. His legs were tied. His hands were tied. More than a dozen guards, as I understand, were involved. He was pepper sprayed twice and he had a spit hood. They mercilessly took his life. And the tragedy in all this is that accountability hasn't been served. And, you know, since his death, my family has been struggling with that pain. But he endured a level of violence that no human being deserves. And he endured a level of violence that a man of his vulnerability never deserved either. He was, you know, he needed help. Instead, you know, he got fists. Instead, he got fists and cuffs. He needed a doctor.
Mm-hmm. It must have been really hard to lose your brother.
It still is, Rikesh, because we don't have our closure. I remember that fateful day, that evening when two police officers, you know, came to my family's home, when they informed my father that my brother had died. We're still in pain. We're still struggling. But what has happened to my brother and what my family is enduring is not right. It is not right, and it's not fair what we're going through. My brother was killed under government care. He was at the custody of the state. And we still don't have our answers. We're still not given the most significant question that we've asked. Why was Suleiman killed? To this day, we don't have that answer.
So how did the Justice for Suleiman campaign come to be?
So after Suleiman's death, you know, my family, we were struggling a lot. And but it was a conscious effort for my family. We had to speak out. We had to speak out to make sure that another family does not go through what we've been through, going through. And there was a specific conversation with my mother who told me, said, "I want accountability for my son." And this was my mother in tears telling me this. She said, "Yusuf, I need to know, you know, we deserve to know what happened to our son." And so what I did was, after that conversation with other family members as well, myself and a couple of friends decided to start the Justice for Sully movement. And our mandate, our immediate mandate, is to call for, you know, to call for accountability and transparency on the individuals that took Suleiman's life.
That's really important work. Your brother's story was actually recently featured on Fifth Estate. It's interesting because the prisoner who is in the cell beside Suleiman, who is in segregation, in the segregation unit, he said he didn't think your brother should have been in prison in the first place. If it was so obvious to everyone else that Suleiman shouldn't have been in prison, you must wonder why it wasn't obvious to the correctional authorities.
You know, it's a very important question, and it's a very important statement that the fella stated. People with mental illness should not be in prison. People with mental illness should be in hospitals. People with mental illness should be around doctors, around individuals that have the appropriate tools to take care of them. And even when family members that are trying to help, you know, people that are suffering mental illness, that was cut from Suleiman. One of the most important things, and the prison took that away from my family. My family was not able to see Suleiman in those 11 days. They took one of the most important aspects. They took the support. That's not very hard to understand. That's very, very straightforward. I think people in this country, in Canada, will agree with that.
So we're talking about imagining a future beyond prisons on this episode. And I'm wondering if you could paint a picture of what it would look like when someone needs mental health supports and someone needs community support and the government systems are supporting them as well. What would that look like in your opinion?
I hope for a society where someone like Suleiman or Justin Saint-Amour or Ashley Smith, where they are treated with compassion, they're treated with empathy, they're treated in a society or in an institution that is supposed to take care of, meet their needs, that they're not segregated, that they're not isolated, that they're not left alone to rot and die. You know, a society that gives them what they deserve, gives them what is their right. But I envision or I imagine a society where people like Suleiman would be treated by a doctor, where his family is able to support him, where family is allowed to support him, things that were not given to him.
I hope, after hearing from Yusuf, you'll agree that it's time to imagine something better. Next, I speak with someone who is doing just that. Debbie Kilroy is one of Australia's leading advocates for protecting the human rights of women and children through decarceration. She defines decarceration as a process of moving away from using prisons and other systems of social control in response to crime and social issues. Debbie's passion for justice is a result of her personal experience of the criminal justice system, or injustice system, and an unwavering belief that prison represents a failure of justice. After her release in 1992, Debbie established Sisters Inside, which advocates for the human rights of women in the criminal justice system and responds to gaps in the services available to them. Sisters Inside has won international recognition for its work and its unique structure, which ensures it is driven by women with lived prison experience. So I caught Debbie and Kim at the same time, which is incredible. In New York. What are you folks up to there?
We're here to speak at Beyond the Bars conference at Columbia University this weekend.
Debbie, do you think you could tell us a bit more about Sisters Inside and why you started the organization?
So Sisters Inside fundamentally came out of prison when I was released. We had a long-term as a lifers committee inside the prison. And when I was released on parole, I said I would be back. Now, many people say they'll come back, but it's difficult, you know, for people on release to get their feet planted into the free world and move on and then come back and support our sisters. However, I had the opportunity to go back quite regularly because we had the committees already established, and from that, Sisters Inside started. So we basically have four arms of the organisation: service provision and programs, law reform and advocacy and activism, community education, and also we have a law firm attached to the two Sisters Inside as well that does criminal defence law.
You also have a Free the People campaign going on that's raised over $380,000. I'm wondering how it came to be and why.
We run different campaigns at different times, and pretty much they're spontaneous. So those that know me know that I come up with lots of ideas and put them into action. And so it was a Sunday afternoon at home when I noticed on social media a young Aboriginal man in Western Australia, so the other side of the country from where I live, was arrested on a warrant for non-payment of his fines some 5-6 years prior that he didn't know about. And he was taken immediately to prison. So we put it out on social media. The money was raised within a couple of hours and he was released that afternoon. And when I was thinking about him being arrested for unpaid fines, I was thinking of Miss Du, who's a young Aboriginal woman who was killed in the watch house. Police were called out to where she lived because she was a victim of domestic and family violence. And when the police arrived, they arrested her because she had a warrant for unpaid fines. So basically, she was criminalised because of poverty. She was put in the watch house and she was there for 3 days in absolute agony. She had a number of medical issues. She was taken to a health centre. They kept turning her away. They were calling her a liar, a drug addict, as well as a number of racist names. And she actually ended up dying inside the concrete cell, and the treatment of her was horrific. So I was thinking of her with great sadness about her arrest and her death in the watch house because she was poor and couldn't pay fines. And then her coronial inquest occurred 2 years after that, and the coroner made findings that the law be changed. The government, so the Labor government, which is like our so-called left government was not in power at the time, but they made a lot of noise in the election, coming up election, to say that they would change the laws. They were voted in. They've been in power now for 2 years, and they still haven't changed the laws. So we're still seeing predominantly Aboriginal women and men being put in prison for unpaid fines. So basically poverty-related offences. So when I was sitting home, that's what I was thinking about. I thought, okay, I'm going to try one of these GoFundMe pages where you ask people to donate money. And I thought my target was going to be middle class, white middle class Australia, where I asked them to give up two coffees in the week and get 10,000 people to give up two coffees, which is about $10. $10, 10,000 donors to raise $100,000 to try and get released 100 Aboriginal mothers or Aboriginal women not go to prison because of warrants and they're sort of hiding from the police because they will be arrested. Within 36 hours, the generosity was quite overwhelming. We'd already raised $125,000. By the end of 4 or 5 days, we're up to $250,000. And now, because we've also had donations directly to us, that the people aren't donating directly on the GoFund page, so we have over $400,000 raised now. So we've paid over 100 Aboriginal women's fines and a number of women. So the prison also rings us. As soon as a woman's arrested and put in prison, the prison contacts us and then we pay the woman's fines and she's released immediately.
So I'm wondering if you could talk more about why it's important that Sisters Inside is led by women with lived experience of incarceration.
Well, as we say, nothing about us without us. That's the reality. You know, so much has been done to us without us, whether it's services, programs, whether it's advocacy, whether it's research. You know, it's all the experts, supposed experts and professionals with maybe a tertiary degree that actually informs everything about us and no one talks to us. So the importance originally for us back in the early 90s is about a voice, because we didn't have a voice. Like, it really, no one really knew what was happening to women in prison. So for us, it was about having a voice.
So you and Kim are friends. You're pretty good friends. How did you guys meet?
Back in the 90s? Yeah, it would have been. No, the 90s, yeah. So we have in Australia called the Australian Institute of Criminology. So they do a lot of research around the issues of crime and justice. But they'd never done anything about women. So I was lobbying them for a long time to have a conference, because they have the resources, around women in prison. However, in their wisdom, and I'm being sarcastic, they decided to have a conference around women in corrections. Because, you know, we like to call prisons corrections, but go figure. They had a conference, Women in Corrections. I don't know if Kim wants to tell the story about how she was invited, but, you know, there was a group of us activists from around the country that went to Adelaide, so that's down south of where I live. Kim was actually one of the keynote. Yeah, and so what we decided to do, because there was like 300 people, which is quite huge back in the 90s for a conference, in Australia. So we decided to, and like the majority were all the women predominantly who worked in the prison system, like, you know, and there was what, maybe 15 of us. But yeah, so we decided to do some action at the conference to make an impact, considering there was like 300 people employed by the prison industry. So we did a strip search, a live strip search, how it happens to us women in prison. And people in corrections from Queensland, you know, I remember getting in the lift that night, I can't remember, anyway, over the conference, and we don't do that to women, and they're crying. It's like, yeah, you do. You do it every day. It's happening right now. Like, they were dismissing it and, like, freaking out because it was so in their face. This is the policy that you put in place, and this is what you do every day to us, and you saw it, and you can't deny it. And they tried every which way to deny it.
Well, and the other thing that happened, though, in Canada, when Amanda came over a few years later, she was doing some research, and she spoke about this actually at the Senate Human Rights Committee, because when we were visiting Nova Institution,
and at some of the other prisons, we found out that, in fact, all of the heads of security for the prisons for women across Canada had submitted a proposal to Correctional Service of Canada to stop doing routine strip searches because of the trauma inflicted on women and the fact that, you know, 91% of the Indigenous women, about 87% of the women overall, had histories of physical and or sexual abuse, and that it achieved no security purpose. That's the reason it was ostensibly done. But it created all this trauma and actually interfered with any ability to have any kind of positive relationship between staff and prisoners. But it was rejected by the Correctional Service of Canada. So it was useful to have that. But the first time really Canadians started to focus on the issue of strip searching for women was after the G20 in Toronto, when they scooped up a whole bunch of people from the streets, and disproportionately the women, some of them lawyers, some of them, you know, members of the public, tourists, whoever, journalists, were all picked up. And disproportionately, the women were strip searched. And so it became, I think that's the first time in Canada, to my knowledge, outside of those women who'd been in prison or women who were going into prisons regularly, it had become clear as an issue because people weren't paying attention to it. And I think it's buried again now because that was a few years back now.
Well, both of you do a lot of work on imagining futures beyond prisons and trying to help people around the world, Canada, Australia, imagine that future as well. One question that I know I get sometimes is, you know, are you trying to say that we should release all the most dangerous prisoners into Canadian society? What do you say to that?
Well, at the end of the day, we all get labels. And so I think we need to start unpacking the labels in that sense. And we could release all the women in Queensland prisons, the jurisdiction that I come from, and the crime rate would go up. The thing is, what has to happen is, though, the resources have to follow the women out into the community, because the women that we know that are in prison are Aboriginal women. They're poor women. They have histories of horrific violence, sexual, physical, emotional violence. Many have mental health issues. Many have drug addictions or alcohol addictions due to the abuse that they've suffered from a baby childhood through young teenhood and adulthood. They're the issues that have to be addressed. So we can unpack the prison and dismantle it very quickly if you started by releasing all the women who have health issues, for example, whether it's physical health or mental health, intellectual disability. We could decarcerate and release all the women that are in there for poverty-related offences straight away. We could even release all the women that are there for violent offences in the context of particularly what we're seeing now is Aboriginal women being criminalised for defending themselves against violent partners under the so-called domestic and family violence laws, because the laws are degendered, the way that the women are being, well, the way that the laws are being enforced is now the Aboriginal women are being targeted and criminalised and imprisoned. We can release those women because they have committed what we call a reactive violent offence in defending themselves against a violent partner. We've got to stop giving police so much power and prisons so much power under the guise of community safety, because they're the industries that actually ensure that communities are unsafe.
You know, we're not talking about suddenly just opening up all the doors and having, you know, people running free in the streets. But the reality is, in Canada, for instance, in the mid-1990s, all the heads of corrections who were then male got together, and they said didn't even consider women. I mean, in Canada, the same thing applies that Debbie has just said for women. Most of them are there. If they're in for violent offenses, it's mostly reactive. I can only think of one woman in nearly 40 years that I've met that committed a predatory, what would be described as a predatory act of violence. These guys got together, the heads of corrections, and they said, so these are the men dealing with mostly men in corrections, said that they could release 75% of the men then in custody and not increase the risk to public safety and not increase crime. So that's the people in charge of our prisons who were saying that. Well, there was the fellow who was the head of the federal prison system at the time, who actually started to try and set some quotas on having to get a certain amount of people out, 50% out. And he got pilloried for it by most everybody, even though all of the evidence showed that that was true. So, you know, I think one of the things is it's far easier to say that the way we're dealing with violence against women or violence in general or inequality is that when someone does something wrong, we smack them with a sentence. And the barometer that's too often used is how serious, how long is the sentence? How punitive is the sentence as a measure of how much we value the victims or that we're dealing with the victimization. And I think that's there's no evidence that that actually is, it protects people or that it's, it keeps the community safe. Yet we continue to see that resurrected. And it's the easiest thing for elected officials to do because they can show something that they do something. They impose a longer sentence, a more punitive sanction, less access to parole, longer time to wait for a record suspension or no pardons or whatever it is. And it's something that can be done with an electoral cycle. Part of what we should be looking at, though, is a much longer term of what's going to be in the interest of the Canadian public for everybody. But in our instance, a Canadian public or Australian public in the long term. And that is that we invest in community and put resources there. And when I worked with male sex offenders, and, you know, I've worked for a long time with men and women and young people who've been convicted of killing people as well, almost invariably, those individuals themselves never get over, if I can put it that way. They're remorseful. They, if they could bring back lives, if they could undo what they've done, they would do that. So those individuals really, we're talking about the need for public to feel that something's been done. The very few that are committing monstrous acts that, you know, may have mental health issues, may be for whatever other reason so far gone. I think we have to, you know, come to an understanding of how did they get there? Because in most of the cases, the men that I know of who committed really monstrous acts first had other things done to them. It doesn't excuse their behavior, and nothing I'm saying should be heard as condoning, you know, really monstrous and murderous acts. That's not what I'm saying. But if we don't understand it, how do we prevent it from happening to other people? How do we prevent people from continuing on in that behavior? And I think there are lots of things that we condone all the time. The fact that we've got the Me Too and the fact that we don't take seriously violence against women and particularly misogynist or sexualized violence against women and kids is a huge issue. And so really, I think it's pulling the lid off of or the Band-Aid off that we keep trying to put on as though we're fixing these issues and demand that we fundamentally look at what some of the issues are. And inequality is a big part of it. Lack of access to resources is a big part of it. And really a sense of community that comes from people having their basic needs met and having opportunities then to be involved in their community in a way that is meaningful to them. And so we're talking about a much longer term strategy. And one of the things that attracted me to actually, you know, letting my name stand for the Senate was the fact that part of our responsibility is to be looking at the long term interests of Canadians, not just acting to get elected within a 4-year electoral cycle. And so I think it is a long term project and requires us to take the steps we can do now.
Kim, we are in the throes still of the SNC-Lavalin controversy, and it strikes me that so much time and resources continue to go into finding ways for corporations to not be held criminally responsible for, you know, whatever actions they take. And I'm wondering when or how we can start taking this action for people.
Well, we have been for quite a few years, for decades actually, for young people. We've had within the first the Young Offenders Act and then the Youth Criminal Justice Act, the opportunity for young people to not be held responsible, to be diverted out of the system. We used to have diversion programs for adults as well. And in fact, when the deferred prosecution agreement provisions were being introduced, one of the questions I had for the minister at the time was, why? Why are you introducing these? For what purpose? What's the genesis? What was the impetus for this? And I didn't really get an answer. But the reason I was asking those questions is because if we're providing an opportunity for corporations to be held, to not be held criminally responsible, to make recompense, to remedy the harms they've caused in exchange for not having a criminal conviction, why on earth would we not offer that to individuals who are charged under the criminal code? Why do we privilege corporations? And the answers have ranged from, well, they represent economic development. And really what the answer is they have money and they have power and they have resources and influence. And, you know, the individual who's charged, the young person, the racialized person, the person with mental health issues who's charged, doesn't have the same kinds of resources, influence, and power. And that's just not right. And that violates our Constitution, in my view.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Appointed. As usual, please rate us and subscribe to us on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts.